Speaker, Ginger Kay.
Hi, my name's Ginger and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Ginger.
Not only did I not volunteer for this, but I have to be called on first. I have a sponsor who kept telling me to get into service. So I decided I'd like to help out with the roundup, but I thought I'd be serving coffee, not standing up here. What happened? My first AA meeting was in 1973. That's not when I came into the program. In between 73 and 1981, when I finally did quit drinking, I was in and out of psychiatric hospitals. I was very suicidal. I had electric shock treatments in one of these psychiatric hospitals. I had psychiatrists giving me pills, telling me that I didn't have problems, that once I got rid of all my problems, the drinking would stop. And so I continued to drink for several more years. In 1981, March 6, I remember sitting at my dining room table, and a very good friend of mine came over who was not alcoholic, and she says, "I can't let you see you kill yourself this way." And she took me to a treatment center. My first impression was that this was just another hospital. And I was scared to death. I thought I had lost my family. I have a husband and four kids, and with the grace of God, I still have that husband and four kids. Four kids I'd like to get rid of once in a while, but, you know. And my husband was to the point of leaving me. In fact, the night I went into treatment, he was out looking for a place, and he was taking the kids away from me. I got into treatment, I listened, and I knew this is what I wanted. But I didn't want to go to all those damn meetings. So I had a very good friend I went through treatment with who gave me no option when I got out. She just said, "I'm picking you up tonight, and we're going to a meeting." Well, I thought, all right, I'm getting out of the house. And sober, that was fine. I stayed sober for 2.5 years on step 1 and 12. I avoided step meetings like the plague. I went to only open meetings or closed meetings as long as there were no steps involved. Once I moved here, I moved over here in October. I decided that I was well and I was no longer going to all those meetings. I walked into one meeting after I'd been here 2 weeks, didn't like it. All I saw were a bunch of old men. And I thought, this isn't for me. So I sat home for almost 2 months and became so sick without alcohol. I did all the same things I was doing in my drinking days without the alcohol. And it was much worse because I had nothing to ease the pain. My husband was to the point of putting me in Mid-Columbia Mental Health Center. He didn't know what was wrong. I called my sponsor up in Everett and told her that I didn't know what was wrong with me. And she said, "Are you going to meetings? "No, but I don't like them over here." And she said, "Go until you do." But I didn't hear that. I continued that road until one night I got a call saying my father was dying of cancer. I have already lost my mother when I had 7 months of sobriety to cancer. I knew that I had a choice to make at that time. It was either go to meetings or drink. Why I went to a meeting, I have no idea. But you know, the thing that amazed me is the meeting that I went to, it was all the same people were at that first meeting, but they had really changed their attitude. I sat, I listened, and this is the first time in the 3 years I have been on the program that I have been listening. I stayed sober, as I said, on 1 in 12. Why, I don't know why I stayed sober. Life has been beautiful. I didn't gain any more money. I did gain charge cards, which has gotten rid of more money. I didn't gain any more beauty. I didn't gain a lot of those things. I have gained a peace of mind that I have never had in my life because of alcohol. Alcohol was my best friend and my worst enemy. This program has been a lifesaver for me. I could never have made it through my mother's death without the people in this program. I'm now hearing all those trite little sayings that I see up on the walls at AA meetings. I'm listening to them now. I got roped into going to a step meeting, though. A very good friend here on the program asked me to come to a Monday night meeting because of something that was going on. And I said, sure, not realizing it was a step meeting. So I walk in and here everybody has their books. And I thought, oh, shit. What have I gotten myself into? At that point, I had also decided to quit biting my fingernails. Well, I no longer have fingernails. I'm having to work the steps. And it's not as bad as I thought it would be. It's, there's work to it, and I know there's work, and there's a lot of pain, but I've heard in this program, there's no growth without pain. And this is a simple program, and it has saved my life. I took a trip back to Texas the 1st of April and to see my dad. That town, Houston, Texas, has no serenity whatsoever. The freeways were horrible. The driving was horrible. I didn't get to a meeting while I was down there, but I made AA contact on the phone. And that helped me get through. While I was down there, I realized that almost everyone in my family is also alcoholic, but they're still out there practicing. I no longer have to do that. Today I have a choice. AA has given me that choice. It's given me the choice to live. And that's at the point I was in my drinking. It was living or dying. I heard someone say not so long ago that we have the choice to either go insane, to die, or to sober up. I celebrated my third birthday on St. Patrick's Day, which was the best drinking day of my life. And the way the meetings here that I go to celebrate, it was on the third Saturday of the month, and it really, you know, that floored me because I thought, that's a miracle in itself, me sitting in an AA meeting celebrating a birthday on St. Patrick's Day. When I went back to Houston, Texas, I went into a bar that I had gotten a 10-year pin for going there for 10 years. And my husband was very upset when I did come home with that pin for 10 years. And I said, it's the only thing I've ever been consistent in my life. And it was, not realizing what I was saying. I drank. And when I went back, I've always kidded about those same people being on the same bar stools. Well, here after 5 years of living in Washington, going back to Texas, I walked in that bar because I just had to see what it was like. And those same people were on those same bar stools. And the owner of the bar told me I could come back and visit any time, but not to stay because I'd be bad for business. So it's great to be sober, and I'm happy to be alive. And may your tomorrows be blessed with sobriety, peace of mind, and a quiet heart, one day at a time. Thank you.
Thank you, Ginger. I think I know how you felt when you came into AA. She said she's seen a lot of old men sitting around on chairs. Well, when I walked in, not being the oldest person in the room, I seen everybody along the left side of the wall had white hair. And I thought, oh my God, I thought, it must be an old folks home. And I then noticed that there were some younger people there too, and I thought, maybe they just let the older people out of their home to go to their meetings. I soon figured out that age has nothing to do with it. But if you would like contrast from the younger to the older, I have a next speaker's good friend of mine. Shorty, would you like to say something?
Those were famous last words. I'm Shorty, and I'm an alcoholic. When I was told that I was going to be on this panel, and when I saw what the title was, I realized that it was a title we had discussed in our committee meetings, and it's very close to my heart. I don't give much of a drunkologue. There are people that are talented in doing it. But I found out that I had to practice honesty an awful long while before I could give an honest drunkologue. I don't know if you folks have noticed when a person comes on the program and gives his first little pitch, how that changes from time to time. The drunkologue becomes a little different. I'm just going to give you one incident. back in my drinking days, and before it was got so bad it was affecting me physically, I was working down in Wichita, Kansas. I was a kind of a, I should by this time have a better word than half-assed, but I guess that's the one I've got to use, athlete. And I was supposed to play ball with a commercial team down there that eventually became the Wichita Henrys. They were called the Henry Hockadays at that time. And that's one of the reasons I'm nicknamed Shorty. You're not 5 foot 9 inches and do very much basketball playing. But I did. And it was in the fall of the year and we weren't going to start practice, but I had this job with the Dahl and Yingling Chevrolet Company, that was part of the deal. And I and a fellow by the name of Don, Mr. Yingling, come to us and says, well, we really haven't got too much work for you, but I've got a couple of tickets to the World Series in St. Louis. And so he give it to us and give us each $50 advance to go to St. Louis and watch the World Series. And we got as far as Kansas City, and we drank, and we drank, and pretty soon we realized we didn't have enough money to get on to St. Louis, and so if we couldn't get to St. Louis, we hocked our World Series tickets, and we drank that up. And we realized what we'd done. We'd spent the money, we'd spent the tickets, we had to go back to Wichita, and we couldn't tell them we hadn't been to the series. So we kept our nose to the radio. We read every article in the paper there was. And we knew that World Series by heart. I mean, we did. From Grover Alexander and his pitching stunt drunk all the way through. And we told this story when we got home. And we told it all over. And we kept telling it and telling it and telling it. And I got on the program and I kept telling this story. I had been to the World Series. They invited me back to St. Louis in 1972 at their conference, and I got there at St. Louis, and the guy come met me at the airport, and he took me off. He said, "Ever been in St. Louis before?" I said, "Yeah, I was here for the..." I've never been in St. Louis in my life. And if you don't think that was tough to overcome. So I'm awfully careful with drunkologues. What's fantasy and what's fact is sometimes awfully hard to separate. But I know what happened. And that's what counts. I was sitting on 3rd and Minna Street, south of Market in San Francisco, in January of 1949. And I bumped into a guy. I was going to either jump off the bridge or get rid of my drinking, and I knew I couldn't get rid of my drinking, so I had made plans to jump off the bridge. And you know, I was a failure at that too. I wasn't even able to commit suicide. I couldn't get rid of the shakes enough, so I'd have to go get a few drinks so I could get up that long ramp so I could jump. And by that time, it was always too late in the day. And I did that for several days. But anyway, I was going. I had 40 cents. I can remember. I had 40 cents in my pocket. And I'm down there, and I run across the street. And I bumped into a guy going into the joint. And he didn't get mad. I wanted him out of the road. He didn't belong down there. He had a clean suit and a tie and all these nice things on. But he wasn't rough about it. All he did was turn me around and look at me and says, "Fella, you drink too much." And I says, "Who the hell doesn't know that?" And he asked me if I'd like to be sober. And I says, "Anybody'd like to be sober. Facetious me." And he says, "I didn't ask you that. I asked you if you'd like to be sober." I says, "You're talking to the wrong guy. I've tried everything. I'm one of those guys that never is going to get sober." He says, "I didn't even ask you if you thought you could get sober." And I asked him who he was, a Salvation Army? And he says, "No. I and a couple of my buddies are down here looking over the old homestead, and you look so much like I must have looked, I thought I better talk to you." They sat me down in a little booth there with two other guys that had clean suits on, and they were AA members. And they started talking to me. And they told me that I didn't have to drink anymore, and they told me that there was a way to live. And they told me they used to be down around here, and they found out they didn't have to drink anymore. And they finally got me, so I quit shaking and quit puking and all the things that you do if you've drank hard and stopped quick. And they got me to the downtown group of the San Francisco on Bush Street there in the old French Catholic Church in the basement. There was about 30, I used to say 40, but as you gradually get honest, you tell the truth. There's about 30 guys there. He brought me in there and sat me down, and I never in my life knew I was in so much in the wrong place as I knew that night. I mean, they did things. I'm telling you what happened when I came to AA. They opened with a prayer, and who the hell wanted a prayer? I was son of a Methodist minister. I was an authority on prayer. Look what happened to me knowing everything about prayer. This God business they talked about was a guy that had only one word in his whole vocabulary, and that was no. And I sure I didn't want him. If I wanted to listen to prayer and hear something like that, I could get out the mission. They'd at least give you a night's sleep and something to eat the next morning if you'd go over there. That's more than they were going to do me there. But I sat there. And I'll never know to this day, except realizing there's a tremendous force in AA that it kept me sitting on my hands on that chair when I knew I didn't belong there and I didn't want to be there. I heard a guy talk about God, and that really clinched it. I heard another guy talk about a spiritual life, and who wants that? I'd tried that. Then to clinch everything, they closed it with a prayer. I'm ready to get drunk. Except three bastards took a hold of me and took me down to the Alano Club. And they kept talking to me and feeding me coffee till it was too late. And I still had three nights coming in the flop house. They'd paid a week's rent for me, $3.50. Those three men were named Jack Irving, Holland Pyle, and Ted Hunt. They're all three dead today. Many of you know Jack Irving, used car salesman. Holland Pyle, an outlawed lawyer who had been disbarred. Ted Hunt had been quite a financial expert on Montgomery Street. Real old timers, one of them had 3 years of sobriety. One of them picked me up the next day, 6 o'clock in the morning. Took me with him as he made his rounds. We went over to Oakland. Got close to noon, we parked the car. He says, I'll be out in 20 minutes and I'll take you to lunch if you feel like eating. I had a quarter in my pocket. He parked in front of a saloon or tavern. He went down the street a little while and in, and I looked, now, I had two bits, I could get beer. And I sat there and I was going in. But I didn't. Uh-uh. That guy is being too nice. I can't crap on him like that. I can't do it to the guy. I'll wait till he gets me home and then I'll have my beer. What happened? People cared about me. That's what happened. They showed me they cared. They showed me they wanted me to have it good. That's what happened. That first night, the guy walked up to me by the name of Jack Irving. He says, I'm your sponsor. And boy, he was. I says, what's a sponsor? He says, a guy, you don't take all this garbage of the things you do and put it on the AA table. In AA, you come and talk about what you're doing with these steps that we're talking about, the program. That garbage, you talk to me about it, and I'll help you with that. If I don't know the answer, I'll find somebody that is. I don't want to know about you. The group doesn't want to know about your income tax trouble. The group doesn't want to know about your matrimonial trouble. The group doesn't want to know that you deserted your kid. The group doesn't want to know about all the checks that are bouncing around and the bonding company that's after you. They came here to find out how they're to stay sober, and they want to hear how you're staying sober. That's what the AA program is. And he was tough. He says, now there's some rules when I'm your sponsor. He says, number one, we have to be at the same meeting at least once a week. Number two, you can't have two sponsors. Every alcoholic is too much of a con artist to have two sponsors. He'll pick the one that will like his story the best and give him the answer he wants each time. I want to know your whole story, and I want to be the one that gives you the answer. If you don't want me for a sponsor anymore, that's perfectly all right, because if you don't practice, I'm sure by that time I don't want anything to do with you either. But while I'm your sponsor, I'm going to be the only one. And he says another thing is that we don't give you a big book around here. You have to buy one. And I know you can't buy one now, but they got a couple of copies down at the club. You can go down there and read it until you can buy one. Because if you're like most alcoholics, you'll want to get it straight from the horse's mouth. And that's in the big book called Alcoholics Anonymous. And we didn't have the 12 steps and traditions and anything else. We only had that book and a little red book that was printed in Minneapolis to explain a little bit about the steps. So we had to kind of figure them out ourselves or get somebody else to tell us. Says another thing you're going to have to do, and that's find a home group. He says, this program will give you something, but there's an irrevocable law that says in order to receive, you must give. And you must give of yourself. I says, how can I, as broke as I am? He says, well, you can give of yourself. You really want to? I says, yeah. All right, straighten up the chairs after the meeting. And for 1 month, I folded chairs and piled them after the meeting. That was giving back something. And that's what a home group became to me, a place where I could pay back a little bit of what I got. And it's been almost a sacred thing with me. I've always had a home group. I had an office in AA whereby people made fun of me because I wouldn't go and make a report on a Sunday night. That was my home group night. And I got told, what does it mean? You mean you can't miss your meeting for this? I says, that's right. Please tell me where AA is, will you? AA is a group. My sponsor told me that. I've never found anything else. And so I went to groups. Well, I got a job. I won't go into this. I got some work. Not very much, but a little bit. And I got my first paycheck, $22. And I went and saw Jack, and Jack took $3.50 out of it right away. And he says, now you can buy a big book. And was I mad? $22, a lousy check like that, and he takes $3.50 off the top. But he went and got the book and brought it back to me, and he says, now you can go to work. And he says, I want you to make me a promise. I says, for what? He says, it's none of your business. I says, yeah, but you said you've got to make... I want your promise. Don't worry about what it is. Just give me your absolute promise you'll do it. I says, okay. He says, there's a chapter called Chapter 5 in the big book, and there's 2.5 pages there. And I says, I know, I hear it at every meeting. And he says, well, he says, books are to be read by people, not to people. And I'd all of a sudden, I remembered that that's true. I'd been listening to things read in AA, and one night they called me up. I'd been sober about 6 weeks and says, read the definition of AA. And I started reading, you know, one, we always, a preamble, we always read it. And I got down a ways and I stopped. It says, we are not affiliated with any sect. I thought they said sex all the time. And I'll tell you, changed the program reading it myself. And so when he said, you read it yourself if you really want to know what it says, I believed him. But he says, you're going to do it 15 nights in a row. You're going to open that book just before you go to sleep, and you're going to read it slowly out loud to yourself. And I promised, and I did. Did it for about 4 nights. Come home late. Reached up there, that little room I had, and pulled the chain, turned the lights out, crawled in bed, and couldn't go to sleep. Got up after a while, nope, pulled the chain, light went on, took my book off the shelf, read chapter 5, the 2.5 pages, put it back and went to sleep. Next night I got home, I grabbed the book right away because I knew I wasn't going to go to sleep. That's what put me to sleep, reading that. But something else started happening. Words started jumping out. All of a sudden, I realized the first sentence was a long sentence. It wasn't a short sentence. Rarely does a person fail. That's all I ever saw. But all of a sudden, I realized there was more to it. Rarely does a person fail who thoroughly follows our path. Now there, that, holy man, there's more to it than that. I got to do something. And then down a little farther it says, if you have the capacity to be honest. And I worried about that because I knew there wasn't an honest bone in my body. And all of a sudden I realized, I saw that picture on our farm. I saw that oil barrel with a sign on the outside that said capacity 55 gallons. It had a capacity for 55 gallons even when it was empty. Capacity had nothing to do with quantity in existence. Capacity only meant that there was a place to put that much. So I asked Dr. Poliak once, how does a person know whether they have the capacity to be honest? He says, if you know the difference between right and wrong, you have the capacity to be honest. So I figured I had the capacity to be honest. That helped. And then down there farther, it said something else. It says, half measures availed us nothing. And I thought about that. And it said, you get rid of your old ideas. And I was so sure I didn't have any. And then I thought, I sure did. I had an old idea of God that I had to get rid of and get a new one. And then one place it said, the third step, which I wouldn't pay any attention to, it said, made a decision to turn your will and your life over to the care of God as you understood Him. And after about the seventh reading, it told me what it meant to tell me. It didn't tell me I turned my will and life over to the care of God as we understood. It said I made a decision to. When one come along, I could understand. And I knew the decisions were something anybody could make. I'd made 1,000 of them to stop drinking. But that didn't stop my drinking. It's the action that stopped the drinking. And so I knew I could go on with the program as long as I will. Look unto a power greater than myself if I could understand that. And this program proved to be so strong and so forceful that it gave me a tremendous understanding of God. One that is really got some strength and some meaning in it. And it gave me the time to do it. And in those days, you know, we didn't have a lot of experience. We only had the stories of all those people that had been in the action at first. And every once in a while I'd run into one. And I figured I'd run into about 25 of those guys that were in the first 100. And they told me why they wrote those things. Why they made Bill put it down that way. Why the Oxford group's philosophy and absolutes, you don't find them but in an indirect way in there. And they told me all about it. And they told me about the fourth step, and it ain't at all like I hear in meetings now. They told me that isn't an autobiography of yourself, that's a look at yourself. They says, that's where you stand yourself over in a corner and you walk away and turn around and you really look at yourself. And you gotta do that. And what you see is what you gotta work on. And what I saw took a lot of work. And I saw a dishonest person. That meant I had to start getting honest. And I saw an intolerant person. And a person that had no care about the other person. A person that would step on anybody if it would get him an inch ahead by doing so. And I wondered, how in the hell am I going to get anything done? I can't do all these things. And then in reading and reading and reading, you know, when you get towards the end, what it says? It doesn't say, now you have learned these steps. Now you are full of these principles. Now you got a grade of 8 in a scale of 1 to 10 or something like that. All it said, you practice these principles in all your affairs. And I knew what practice was. I even went to the dictionary, and practice meant an earnest endeavor to improve oneself. And I was a friend of Ted Williams, and he was the greatest baseball batter of all time, and he practiced longer and harder than any man in baseball. I can remember when in town here we were talking about him. We had a banquet, and we had a Lefty Gomez here. And I was talking to Lefty Gomez about him, and Lefty says, nobody practiced like him. He hired the scrubs, the guys that were trying to make the team, to come out early in the morning and throw balls to him. Now, if a guy practices that much, and he only bats 400%, and he's the greatest there is, I've got a right that it says, practice these principles. I don't have to be perfect. All I have to do is have an earnest endeavor to improve myself, which a dictionary says is practicing. Now I could be on the program because I was willing to practice these principles because I might sometime get a little good at it. And I've gotten a little bit good at telling the truth. I've got a little bit good at caring about other people. I've got a little bit good about being tolerant. I've become, you see, when I say a little bit good, compared to what I was, I have become tremendously a lot better when I compare myself with what I was. What happened? I did these things. And a good life. After 27 months, my wife thought I was fit to live with again. And this fall, we'll celebrate our 55th wedding anniversary. And when I came on, you know, Irish isn't an old timer. I got 4 months more than he had. Another thing about Irish, too, is he said up here, nobody can say anything in 10 minutes. And I told his brother, I says, he said he can't get anything said in 10 minutes. He says, give him an hour, he still wouldn't have anything said. I believe that. And I'm telling you, this program is beyond all criticism. I'm going to quit with one little sentence. I was invited to talk, to be on a seminar at Eastern Oregon College of Education some years ago. As you know, I was a jockstrap peddler most of my life, and I called on schools and sold them athletic equipment. And they asked me, Reverend Robinson in town there, who asked me if I would be on the panel. It was Religious Emphasis Week, and they were going to talk about prayer that night. And him and I had seen each other a few times. One of his good members was the first member of AA in La Grande, Oregon. And they called on me first, and they says, we want your definition of prayer. And I says, prayer is praying for knowledge of God's will for me and the power to carry it out. And I sat down. And he says, is that all? I says, is there anything more? And so he called on a woman from the Assembly of God, theologian, professor of theology from Montana. She got up, and for 25 minutes she tried to show them how little I knew about prayer. And they asked her afterwards, what did you add to Shorty's definition? And she said, if you don't know that, you didn't listen. And she sat down. And they asked Rabbi Minda of Salt Lake City, who was on the panel, says, now what do you think about Shorty's definition of prayer? And he says, I wouldn't touch it with a 10-foot pole. We have difficulty with prayer because, like our slogan, in its simplicity, we find our difficulty. It's so hard to believe that a simple thing like that is the answer to an alcoholic's problem. This program was for the alcoholic. It isn't all things to all people. And we can be thankful, we alcoholics, that Providence put something down here on earth that could take care of us. And for that, I hope to be forever grateful. Thank you.
Thank you, Shorty. I personally feel, for my own sobriety, it's important to know where we've been so we don't ever have to go back there again. So our next speaker now is Joe A. from Puyallup.
Hi, my name is Joe, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Joe.
You know, they told me when I came to this program that I should stick with the winners. And here you are, and here I am. So let's hear it for the winners. Isn't it great? You know, I'm going to have to revamp my talk today because I've listened to Shorty and pattern my struggle for sobriety on things that I've heard from him. I've listened to so many of his tapes. I bought his tapes on a fluke one time just because it said Shorty H. At Linfield College, I think it was. And I thought, well, he's talking to people from college, so he must be pretty smart. And I listened to that. And I listened, then I got some other tapes and listened to him. And I know about Alabama. I know about when his wife and daughters bought a new sewing machine without his permission. I know about his selling basketballs and footballs, a new rubber product out of a catalog, and when he quit doing it the way he was told to do it out of the book, that's when he failed. His message there was, if you take it out of the book, you won't fail. So you see, I know Shorty. So consequently, I have to change some of the things in my story or in my talk today because Shorty is in there. And that's okay, you know, and it's as it should be that he should talk prior to me. Because I'm just a little fella that don't got too much sobriety. One day at a time, I guess. I don't know whether I got up earlier than he did today, but I have got today. My home group is Puyallup, Washington. My district is District 29. And my sponsor is Ed K. I mention these things because they are important in my struggle for sobriety. Not necessarily in that order. I might mention also that District 29 at this roundup today, we took a count of District 29 members, and we number in excess of 50 today that's here at this roundup from our little district. So I'm kind of proud of that. I have thought about why or how I came to the program Alcoholics Anonymous, and I heard it so many times from my friends and from especially family. Sonny, why do you go to those meetings? You know, you're not an alcoholic. And it seems like our loved ones have the disease of denial the same as we do. They don't want to admit that Sonny was an alcoholic. And I've got to remember, as a child, I went out with my grandpa and his dog on a little hunting expedition. We come down over this hill into a big valley, and out in that valley there was just a single tree, a big oak tree sitting there. And Grandpa saw a bear out there, and he up with his rifle and took a shot at it. Well, he hit the bear and apparently just grazed it. And Old Blue, the dog, he took right out after it to check that out. Well, about that time, the bear came too, you know, and made a swipe to Old Blue, and Old Blue just took off across that meadow, and there was nothing other than that oak tree there. And the bear was gaining on him all the time. And Old Blue just climbed right up that goddamn tree. And I said, Grandpa, how come you tell me this? I says, you know dogs can't climb trees. And he says, well, that dog climbed that tree because he had to. Because he had to. And that's the way it was with me in this program. I came here to this program of Alcoholics Anonymous because I had to. I think of that oak tree, the trunk as the program of AA. And I think of the branches on that tree as the 12 steps and the 12 traditions, which I have had to climb in order to stay sober. So you see, there is some relevancy there in that little story. These things that I talk about today, you wonder, what has that got to do what happened? But all of these things has to do what happened to me when I came to you people. Shorty mentioned half measures. Well, this is the way I practice this program. I came into this program in July of 1977, but I didn't have my last drink until October of 1978. So you see, there was a 15-month lapse there that I was chipping around with this program. I came to this program, and I did half-measured a lot of things. They told me to go to meetings and don't drink between meetings. Well, being rational, half-measure person, I went to lots of meetings and drank between meetings. And consequently, didn't get too much out of it. But you see, they kept telling me to come on back. Keep coming back, they said. Bring the body and the mind will follow. And I think whoever coined that or whoever wrote that must have been very, very wise, because they knew that if any of us kept coming back, eventually some of this program would rub off on us. And that's the way it was with me. After 15 months of playing with it, going to the meetings, I finally got a month of sobriety, or even a week of sobriety. It wasn't long after that, they put me in as a job coffee maker, which put me into service. And that was, I believe, the beginning of some definite kind of recovery, because they trusted me with the key to the church. They trusted me to be there on Thursday and Sunday to make coffee. And you know, I thought I was the best coffee maker that ever hit that Puyallup group. And after my 6-month stint was up, I went on for another 4 months before they finally got another coffee maker in there. But even after that, I thought that I was so good at that coffee making that I couldn't bear to stay out of that kitchen. I was in there clucking around, you know, like an old mother hen, and I finally found that fella that they had in my place could do the job just as good as I could. So you see, that was a little bit of growth there. So that's the way I practice half measures, by doing it halfway. There was some talk, you know, I came into this program when I was 57 years old. And you guys out here, those younger people and some of the middle-aged people, think you had it tough. Well, as a result of being in this program for 2 or 3 years, I finally grew enough so that today I probably have the emotional maturity of about a 14-year-old. And if you think it's tough the way you're working it, you ought to try working this son of a gun going through puberty and senility. It ain't easy, I'll tell you. You know, I've got to think about another time that we were up to a dinner party with some other alcoholic friends. And there was about 6 or 7 of us alcoholics, and there was one Al-Anon lady there. And she happens to be in this room tonight. She just walked in to talking about our drinking. And I says, well, I'd buy a fifth, and it would last me all of today and most of tomorrow. And this Al-Anon lady, she says, well, Joe, you probably aren't even an alcoholic. And you know, I clutched at that just like it says in our program. We clutch at this program like a drowning man clutches at a straw. Well, I clutched at that maybe I wasn't an alcoholic. And I really worked that one over in my mind. But luckily for me, there's some other alcoholic people there that saw what was happening. And finally drove that thought out of my mind that I wasn't really an alcoholic. But today I realize that that Al-Anon lady that told me that I probably was an alcoholic, she had what I think I would term today as an Al-Anon slip. You see, I believe that she had a moment of compassion. This program got me into service, as I said before, and I've gone through several different jobs in this program and love them and keep on working them to the best of my ability. But I think that service is one of the things that will keep us in this program, if nothing else will, because it gives us this sense of responsibility. We belong. We're part of the group. And they trust us to do these things. So service, in my opinion, is very important. I remember another one in Shorty's tapes. He talks about this fella that was invited to come to the business meeting, and the fella says, "Nah, I don't want to get into that politics. That's all politics." He says, "My sponsor says it's politics." Now, Shorty said he knew that the fellow's sponsor, and he was a real good member of AA. But Shorty came up with a statement that those people that call service politics are those people who haven't never been in service. And I think that's a good definition of it. This program, What Happened, has taught me to love you other alcoholics, practicing or non-practicing. I have a love for the people here today. You walk out in that room poolside, and there's one thing it seems like everybody in that out there around those coffee tables and things are wearing. They're all wearing the same thing, and that's a big smile. You see more smiles out there than you'll ever see at any Odd Fellows, Knights of the Columbus, or Elks. Out here we've got a happiness that seems to be contagious. If you're not smiling when you walk in, it isn't very damn long until there is a smile on your face. So these are things that I love about this program. I have learned to work with other people, 12-stepping, and that type of thing, which is so important to us. I've learned to be not sympathetic, but have a feeling of empathy for the people that are trying to get into this program. We had a fellow out here just a little while ago before we came in. He says he's been in the program off and on for 5 years. He says he was sitting across the street drinking, and he heard those other people in that bar saying, "Look at those damn alcoholics, those AAs, what the hell are they doing over there?" You know, and it struck a note with him. He came out here to poolside and was talking to Ed and I. You know, maybe he didn't get it. Maybe we didn't do anything that helped him. But by God, it helped me. You know, he was doing my drinking for me. All I had to do was listen to his tale of woe, and I could relate and thank God and thank you people for this program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And for that, I am grateful. Thank you.
Thank you, Joe. I hear many people say, you know, we don't like to hear drunk logs, do you? You hear a lot of drunk logs. But for me, to forget where I came from, or to forget to be grateful, it wouldn't be very long before I was back there again. I'll never forget my last drunk, and I don't want to, because it keeps me grateful for what it is I have, and that I might not have to go back there. I'd like to thank all our speakers, and we'd like to take questions from the audience or just comments from people. You can direct it to each speaker or to the panel itself. Do we have anybody who would like to ask any questions? Yeah.
Yeah, Jordy started out with the group. I'm a recovering alcoholic. My name is Wally West.
Hi, Wally.
Hi, Wally.
I belong to the First Step group and never meets on Tuesday night beginners. The best group on the whole continent.
This is an honest program, Wally.
I don't get moved, but Shorty started out working. What is a group? You talk about, we can tell new people what AA is all about. I've been told that the wiser and older people, it's your business to carry the message and get that new person to the group. I would like some more reiteration from authority on the importance of the group and why it is AA itself, the foundation of the group.
Jack, say something for me?
I'm a firm believer that I'd like to tell a little story. Some of you have heard it. As you know, sometimes we lose sight of where AA is. And I had a person that was impressing me with his importance in AA. And so he said to me, "What do you think about it?" I says, "I'm glad you asked. To me, the AA program is a big circus tent. Huge tent. And they got some big posts up in the center. And I call them the trustees. And they got some other posts inside there going around, and I call them the delegates. And they got another row of posts inside there going around, and I call them the district committeemen. And on the outside, they got little ropes coming down, and you drive little pegs in the ground, and you tie that rope to it, and you go all around that tent, driving those little pegs in the ground and tying the rope to them. And I call them our GSRs. Now, you can go inside that tent and push on any pole you want to in there, and the chances are that tent is just going to stay right up there. No question about it. You can do everything you want to the trustees, to the delegates and district committeemen. But you go outside that tent and start kicking those little pegs loose and see how many you can kick loose before the whole tent comes down. That's where AA is. Thank you.
Is there any other questions or comments? Dave.
Thanks, Dave.
Is there anyone else? We've had a lot said here tonight. I'm sure there's somebody who's got something. Comments? Who could
I'd like to say enough.
Sure.
Still Joe and still an alcoholic. When I was talking, I neglected probably one of the more important parts of my talk. And that's about my relationship with my higher power. I didn't know a higher power when I came to this program. I had one, but it came in all sorts of shapes, round, square, about this tall mostly. And that was my higher power. But, you know, the thing that led me to have what I consider not a spiritual awakening, but a conscious contact with God as I understand Him. I was out in the, not too long after I came into the program, I was out in my garden weeding my strawberries. And I was down on my knees, so apparently I was in the proper position. And the Serenity Prayer went through my mind. And I said to myself, what in the hell is that doing in there? You know, I said the Serenity Prayer at the beginning of the meeting, and that's all I said. But this Serenity Prayer was there at that particular moment. And in the hour and a half or 2 hours that I was there weeding strawberries, that Serenity Prayer was like a Tibetan prayer wheel, I guess. It went round and round and round in my head. It just was there constantly. And I think that was my first conscious contact with God as I understand Him. Came through that little simple Serenity Prayer. And it wasn't too long afterwards that I condescended to talk to God that night, one night before I went to bed. And as a result of that, I believe that, like it tells us in the 12th tradition, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, and I think that's what happened to me, that I got it from a little simple thing, and it has grown, been nurtured perhaps by you people, and has blossomed today. Thank you. Thank you.
We're just about out of time. Is there anybody who has any questions or comments? Well, then I'd like to thank our speakers. We've heard a lot of good things here today. And I'd like to thank you for letting me chair your meeting. I'd like to close this meeting with the Lord's Prayer. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, and the power, and the glory forever. Amen.
Keep coming back.
You lived through it, didn't you, Captain?
Yeah, sure. It was too short.
It was dandy.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Good.
Thanks, Bill.
You little dog.
Thank you. I didn't do as good as I could.